Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
Well, good afternoon. We're getting started with our discussion. We're going over the section called Pinchas, otherwise known as translated as Phineas, the guy's name, covering Numbers 25, starting roughly verse 10 and going through the first part of chapter 30, verse 1. While Yisrael remained in Shittim, the people began to play the harlots with the daughters of Moab. For they invited the people to sacrifice to their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. So Israel joined themselves to the Baal of Peor, and the Lord was angry against Israel. The Lord said to Moshe, "Take all the leaders of the people and execute them in broad daylight before the Lord, so that the fierce anger of the Lord may turn away from Israel." So Moshe said to the judges of Israel, "Each of you slay his men who have joined themselves to the Baal of Peor." Then behold, one of the sons of Israel came and brought to his relatives a Midianite woman in the sight of Moshe and in the sight of all the congregation of the sons of Israel while they were weeping at the doorway of the tent of meeting. When Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, saw it, he arose from the midst of the congregation and took a spear in his hand, and he went after the man of Israel into the tent and pierced both of them through, the man of Israel and the woman, through the body. So the plague on the sons of Israel was checked, and those who died by the plague were 24,000. Then the Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, "Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aharon the priest, has turned away my wrath from the sons of Israel, and that he was jealous with my jealousy among them, so that I did not destroy the sons of Israel in my jealousy. Therefore say, behold, I give him my covenant of peace, and it shall be for him and his descendants after him, a covenant of a perpetual priesthood. Because he was jealous for his God and made atonement for the sons of Israel. Now, the name of the slain man of Israel who was slain with the Midianite woman was Zimri, the son of Salu, a leader of a father's household among the people of Shimon. And the name of the Midianite woman who was slain was Cozbi, the daughter of Zur, who was the head of a people of his father's household in Midian. Then the Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, be hostile to the Midianites and strike them, for they have been hostile to you with their tricks, which they have deceived you in the affair of Peor and in the affair of Cozbi, the daughter of the leader of Midian, their sister, who is slain on the day of the plague because of Peor." Chapter 26. Then it came about after the plague that the Lord spoke to Moshe and to Eleazar, the son of Aharon, the priest, saying, "Take a census of all the congregation of the sons of Israel from 20 years old and upward by their father's households, whoever is able to go out to war in Israel." So Moshe and Eleazar, the priest, spoke with them in the plains of Moab by the Yarden at Jericho, saying, "Take a census of the people from 20 years old and upward, as the Lord has commanded Moshe." Now the sons of Israel who came out of the land of Mitzrayim were Reuben, Israel's firstborn, the sons of Reuben, of Hanoch, the family of the Hanochites, of Palu, the family of the Paluites, of Hezron, the family of the Hezronites, of Carmi, the family of the Carmiites. These are the families of the Reubenites, and those who were numbered of them were 43,730. The son of Palu, Eliab. The sons of Eliab, Nemuel, and Datan, and Abiram. These are the Datan and Abiram who were called by the congregation, who contended with Moshe and against Aharon in the company of Korah, when they contended against the Lord. And the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up along with Korah when that company died, when the fire devoured 250 men, so that they became a warning. The sons of Korah, however, did not die. The sons of Shimon, according to their families, of Nemuel, the family of the Nemuelites, of Yamin, the family of the Yaminites, of Yachin, the family of the Yachinites, of Zerah, the family of the Zerites, of Shaul, the family of the Shaulites. These are the families of Shimon, 22,200. The sons of God, according to their families, of Zephon, the family of the Zephonites, of Haggi, the family of the Haggiites, of Shuni, the family of the Shunites, of Ozni, the family of Oznites, of Eri, the family of the Erites, of Erod, family of the Erodites, of Areli, the family of the Arelites. These are the families of the sons of God according to those who were numbered of them, 40,500. The sons of Yehuda were Er and Onan, but Er and Onan died in the land of Canaan. The sons of Yehuda, according to their families, were of Shelah, the family of the Shelanites, of Perez, the family of the Perezites, of Zerah, family of the Zerites. The sons of Perez were of Hezron, the family of the Hezronites, of Hamul, the family of the Hamulites. These are the families of Yehuda, according to those who were numbered of them, 76,500. The sons of Issachar, according to their families, of Tola, the family of the Tolites, of Puva, the family of the Punites, of Yashub, the family of the Yashubites, of Shimron, the family of the Shimronites. These are the families of Issachar, according to those who were numbered of them, 64,300. The sons of Zebulun, according to their families, of Sered, the family of the Serites, of Elon, the family of the Elonites, of Yalil, the family of the Yalilites. These are the families of the Zebulunites, according to those who were numbered of them, 60,500. The sons of Yosef, according to their families, Manasseh and Ephraim. The sons of Manasseh, of Machir, the family of the Machirites. And Machir became the father of Gilead, of Gilead, the family of the Gileadites. These are the sons of Gilead. Yezer, the family of Yezerites, Helek, the family of the Helekites, and of Azrael, the family of the Azraelites, and of Shechem, the family of the Shechemites, and of Shemida, the family of the Shemidites, and of Hefer, the family of the Heferites. Now, Zelophehad, the son of Hefer, had no sons, but only daughters. The names of the daughters of Zelophehad were Mahlah, Noah, Hoglah, Miklah, and Tirzah. These are the families of Manasseh. Those who were numbered of them were 52,700. These are the sons of Ephraim according to their families. Of Shetulah, the family of the Shetulites. Of Becher, the family of the Becherites. Of Tahan, the family of the Tahanites. These are the sons of Shetulah, of Aaron, the family of the Aaronites. These are the families of the sons of Ephraim, according to those who were numbered of them, 32,500. These are the sons of Yosef, according to their families. The sons of Benjamin, according to their families, of Bela, the family of the Belites, of Ashbel, the family of the Ashbelites, of Ahiram, the family of the Iramites, of Shephupham, the family of the Shephamites, of Hupham, the family of the Hupamites. The sons of Bela were Ard and Naaman, of Ard, the family of the Ardites, and of Naaman, the family of the Naamites. These are the sons of Benjamin according to their families, and those who were numbered of them were 45,600. These are the sons of Dan according to their families, of Shahum, the family of the Shahumites. These are the families of Dan according to their families. All the families of the Shechemites, according to those who were numbered of them, were 64,400. The sons of Asher, according to their families, of Imnah, the family of the Imanites, of Ishvi, the family of the Ishvites, and of Beriah, the family of the Beriahites, of the sons of Beriah, Heber, the family of the Heberites, of Malchiel, the family of the Malchielites. The name of the daughter of Asher was Serah. These are the families of the sons of Asher, according to those who were numbered of them, 53,400. The sons of Naphtali, according to their families, Yaziel, the family of the Yazielites, of Guni, the family of the Gunites, of Yazer, the family of the Yezerites, of Shalem, the family of the Shalemites. These are the families of Naphtali, according to their families, and those who were numbered of them were 45,400. These are those who were numbered of the sons of Israel, 601,730. Then the Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, among these the land shall be divided for an inheritance according to the number of names. To the larger group you shall increase their inheritance, and to the smaller group you shall diminish their inheritance. Each shall be given their inheritance according to those who were numbered of them. But the land shall be divided by lot. They shall receive their inheritance according to the names of the tribes of their fathers. According to the selection by lot, their inheritance shall be divided between the larger and the smaller groups. These are those who were numbered of the Levites according to their families. Gershon, the family of the Gershonites. Kohath, the family of the Kohathites. Merari, the family of the Merarites. These are the families of Levi, the family of the Levites, the family of the Hebronites, the family of the Malites, and the family of the Mushites, family of the Korites. Kohath became the father of Amram. The name of Amram's wife was Jochebed, the daughter of Levi, who was born to Levi in Mitzrayim. She bore to him Amram, Aharon, and Moshe, and their sister Miriam. To Aharon were born Nadab and Abihu, Eleazar and Itamar. But Nadab and Abihu died when they were offering strange fire before the Lord. Those who were numbered of them were 23,000. Every male from a month old and upward. For they were not numbered among the sons of Israel, since no inheritance was given to them among the sons of Israel. These are those who were numbered by Moshe and Eleazar the priest, who numbered the sons of Israel in the plains of Moab by the Arden at Jericho. But among these there was not a man of those who were numbered by Moshe and Aharon the priest, who numbered the sons of Israel in the wilderness of Shini. The Lord had said of them, they shall surely die in the wilderness, and not a man was left of them, except Caleb the son of Jephunneh, and Yehoshua the son of Nun. Chapter 27. Then the daughters of Zelophehad, the son of Hepher, the son of Gilead, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, of the families of Manasseh, of the son of Yosef, came near. And these are the names of his daughters, Mahla, Noach, Hoglah, Milcah, and Tirzah. They stood before Moshe and before Eleazar the priest and before the elders of all the congregation at the doorway of the tent of meeting, saying, our father died in the wilderness, yet he was not among the company of those who gathered themselves together against the Lord in the company of Korah. But he died in his own sin, and he left no sons. Why should the name of our father be withdrawn from among his family because he had no son? Give us a possession among our father's brothers. So Moshe brought their case before the Lord. Then the Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, the daughters of Zelophehad are right in their statements. You shall surely give them a hereditary possession among their father's brothers, and you shall transfer the inheritance of their father to them. Further, you shall speak to the sons of Israel, saying, if a man dies and has no son, then you shall transfer his inheritance to his daughter. If he has no daughter, then you shall give his inheritance to his brothers. If he has no brothers, then you shall give his inheritance to his father's brothers. If his father has no brothers, then you shall give his inheritance to his nearest relative in his own family, and he shall possess it. And it shall be a statutory ordinance to the sons of Israel, just as the Lord commanded Moshe. Then the Lord said to Moshe, go up to this mountain of Abarim, and see the land which I have given to the sons of Israel. And you have seen it, you too will be gathered to your people, as Aharon your brother was. For in the wilderness of Zin, during the strife of the congregation, you rebelled against my command to treat me as holy before their eyes at the water. These are the waters of Meribah of Kadesh in the wilderness of Zin. Then Moshe spoke to the Lord, saying, may the Lord, the God of the spirits of all flesh, appoint a man over the congregation who will go out and come in before them, and who will lead them out and bring them in, so that the congregation of the Lord will not be like sheep which have no shepherd. So the Lord said to Moshe, take Yehoshua the son of Nun, a man in whom is the Spirit, and lay your hand on him, and have him stand before Eleazar the priest and before all the congregation, and commission him in their sight. You shall put some of your authority on him, in order that all the congregation of the sons of Israel may obey him. Moreover, he shall stand before Eleazar the priest, who shall inquire for him by the judgment of the Urim before the Lord. At his command they shall go out, and at his command they shall come in, both he and the sons of Israel with him, even all the congregation. Moshe did just as the Lord commanded him, and he took Yehoshua and set him before Eleazar the priest and before all the congregation. Then he laid his hands on him and commissioned him, just as the Lord had spoken through Moshe. Chapter 28. Then the Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, command the sons of Israel and say to them, you shall be careful to present my offering, my food for my offerings, by fire, of a soothing aroma to me at their appointed time. You shall say to them, this is the offering by fire which you shall offer to the Lord. Two male lambs, 1 year old, without defect, as a continual burnt offering every day. You shall offer the one lamb in the morning, and the other lamb you shall offer at twilight. Also, a tenth of an ephah of fine flour for a grain offering, mixed with a fourth of a hin of beaten oil. It is a continual burnt offering, which was ordained in Mount Sinai as a soothing aroma, an offering by fire to the Lord. Then the drink offering with it shall be a fourth of a hin for each lamb. In the holy place you shall pour out a drink offering of strong drink to the Lord. The other lamb you shall offer twilight as a grain offering of the morning, and as its drink offering you shall offer it an offering by fire, a soothing aroma to the Lord. Then on the Shabbat day, two male lambs, 1 year old, without defect, two-tenths of an ephah, fine flour mixed with oil as a grain offering and its drink offering. This is the burnt offering of every Shabbat, in addition to the continual burnt offering and its drink offering. Then at the beginning of each of your months, you shall present a burnt offering to the Lord. Two bulls and one ram, 7 male lambs, 1 year old, without defect, and 3/10 of an ephah of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering for each bull, and 2/10 of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering for the one ram, and 1/10 of an ephah of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering for each lamb, for a burnt offering of a soothing aroma, an offering by fire to the Lord. Their drink offering shall be a hin of wine for a bull, and a hin for the ram, and a fourth of a hin for the lamb. This is the burnt offering of each month throughout the months of the year. And one male goat for a sin offering to the Lord. It shall be offered with its drink offering in addition to the continual burnt offering. Then, on the 14th day of the first month, shall be the Lord's Pesach. On the 15th day of this month shall be a feast. Unleavened bread shall be eaten for 7 days. On the first day shall be a holy convocation. You shall do no laborious work. You shall present an offering by fire, a burnt offering to the Lord, 2 bulls and 1 ram and 7 male lambs, 1 year old, having them without defect. For their grain offering you shall offer fine flour mixed with oil, 3/10 of an ephah for a bull and 2/10 for a ram. 1/10 of an ephah you shall offer for each of the 7 lambs, and 1 male goat for a sin offering to make atonement for you. You shall present these besides the burnt offering of the morning, which is for a continual burnt offering. After this manner you shall present daily for 7 days the food of the offering by fire, of a soothing aroma to the Lord. It shall be presented with its drink offering in addition to the continual burnt offering. On the 7th day you shall have a holy convocation. You shall do no laborious work. Also on the day of the first fruits, when you present new grain offering to the Lord in your feast of weeks, you shall have a holy convocation. You shall do no laborious work. You shall offer a burnt offering for a soothing aroma to the Lord, 2 young bulls, 1 ram, 1 male, 7 male lambs, 1 year old, and their grain offering, fine flour mixed with oil, 3/10 of an ephah for each bull, 2/10 for 1 ram, 1/10 for each of the 7 lambs, and also 1 male goat to make atonement for you. Besides the continual burnt offering and its grain offering, you shall present them with their drink offerings. They shall be without defect. Chapter 29. Now in the 7th month, on the 1st day of the month, you shall have a holy convocation. You shall do no laborious work. It will be to you a day for blowing trumpets. You shall offer a burnt offering as a soothing aroma to the Lord, 1 bull, 1 ram, and 7 male lambs, 1 year old without defect. Also their grain offering, fine flour mixed with oil, 3/10 of an ephah for the bull, 2/10 for the ram, and 1/10 for each of the 7 lambs. Offer 1 male goat for a sin offering to make atonement for you, besides the burnt offering of the new moon and its grain offering, and the continual burnt offering and its grain offering, and their drink offerings according to their ordinance, for a soothing aroma, an offering by fire to the Lord. Then on the 10th day of the 7th month, you shall have a holy convocation, and you shall assemble yourselves. You shall humble yourselves. You shall not do any work. You shall present a burnt offering to the Lord as a soothing aroma, 1 bull, 1 ram, 7 male lambs, 1 year old, having them without defect. And their grain offering, fine flour mixed with oil, 3/10 of an ephah for the bull, 2/10 for 1 ram, and 1/10 for each of the 7 lambs. 1 male goat for a sin offering, besides the sin offering of atonement, and the continual burnt offering, and its grain offerings, and their drink offerings. Then on the 15th day of the 7th month, you shall have a holy convocation. You shall do no laborious work, and you shall observe a feast to the Lord for 7 days. You shall present a burnt offering, an offering by fire, as a soothing aroma to the Lord, 13 bulls, 2 rams, 14 male lambs, 1 year old, which are without defect, and their grain offering, fine flour mixed with oil, 3/10 of an ephah for each of the 13 bulls, 2/10 for each of the 2 rams, and 1/10 for each of the 14 lambs, and 1 male goat for a sin offering, besides a continual burnt offering, its grain offering, and its drink offering. Then on the 2nd day, 12 bulls, 2 rams, 14 male lambs, 1 year old without defect, and their grain offering and their drink offerings for the bulls, for the rams and for the lambs, by their number according to the ordinance. And 1 male goat for a sin offering, besides a continual burnt offering and its grain offerings and their drink offerings. Then on the 3rd day, 11 bulls, 2 rams, 14 male lambs, 1 year old without defect, and their grain offering with their drink offerings for the bulls, for the rams and for the lambs, by their number according to the ordinance. one male goat for a sin offering, besides the continual burnt offering and its grain offering and drink offering. Then on the fourth day, 10 bulls, 2 rams, 14 male lambs, 1 year old without defect. Their grain offering and their drink offerings for the bulls, for the rams and for the lambs, by their number according to the ordinance. And one male goat for a sin offering, besides a continual burnt offering, its grain offering and its drink offering. Then on the fifth day, 9 bulls, 2 rams, 14 male lambs, 1 year old without defect. And their grain offering and their drink offerings for the bulls, for the rams and for the lambs, by their number according to the ordinance. And one male goat for a sin offering, besides a continual burnt offering and its grain offering and its drink offering. Then on the sixth day, 8 bulls, 2 rams, 14 male lambs, 1 year old without defect. And their grain offering and their drink offerings for the bulls, for the rams and for the lambs, by their number, according to the ordinance, and one male goat for a sin offering, besides a continual burnt offering, its grain offering, and its drink offerings. Then on the seventh day, 7 bulls, 2 rams, 14 male lambs, 1 year old without defect, and their grain offering and their drink offerings for the bulls, for the rams, and for the lambs, by their number, according to the ordinance. And one male goat for a sin offering, besides the continual burnt offering, its grain offering, and its drink offering. On the eighth day, you shall have a solemn assembly. You shall do no laborious work, but you shall present a burnt offering, an offering by fire, as a soothing aroma to the Lord. 1 bull, 1 ram, 7 male lambs, 1 year old, without defect. Their grain offering and their drink offerings for the bull, for the ram and for the lambs, by their number, according to the ordinance. And 1 male goat for a sin offering, besides a continual burnt offering, and its grain offering, and its drink offering. You shall present these to the Lord at your appointed times, besides your votive offerings and your freewill offerings, for your burnt offerings and for your grain offerings, and for your drink offerings and for your peace offerings. Moshe spoke to the sons of Israel in accordance to what the Lord had commanded Moshe. Then Moshe spoke to the heads of the tribes of the sons of Israel, saying, "This is the Lord, what the Lord has commanded." Okay, that is the end of the reading here. As we get going, are there any questions or comments or observations before we get going too much further? Yes. Oh, hold on just a moment. It's very loud in here right now. Sorry.
I wondered before, and I'm wondering now, how close is the name for Yahshua and Yeshua? How close is that to being the same name?
Well, it virtually is the same name. It's just, you know, a truncation of it. Because you see later on you'll see it. Yeah, sometimes the translation will say Yeshua when you're reading a translation. Well, that's the same as turning it with Yeshua.
Jesus, in the English translation, Jesus had brought them deliverance, but it obviously is praying to Joshua. We call Joshua.
Yeah. And then you had other people whose name were Yeshua. So that's like Yehoshua, you know, is breaks down to one way to break it down is like Yahu and Shua
of his Lord.
You know, the Lord saves, or the Lord is salvation. Would be one way to say that. Which Yeshua is the same. It's actually a shortened form of salvation, because you also see it many times in the Psalms. It'll just be translated, "The Lord is my salvation." In some of those cases, you'll see it. And that's translated from, it'll say, you know, Yeshua. You know, the Lord is my Yeshua, is kind of literally what it's talking about there. So, that's why, you know, the role that he plays, and we'll see it as we move further, as the deliverer, the guy who brings them in, brings them over across the river into the promised land. That's why that parallel, it's a really great messianic figure. That he has a role of someone who brings them in. So, you know, you will call his name Yeshua. That's a really good pointing back to it, to the deliverer. Yeah, so, yes, observation over there.
Well, first, you know, when you were reading that list, it's like over every time you would end, in my mind, I kept thinking of and a partridge and a pear tree, you know. I mean, but on a serious note, when you were reading the tribes and the numbers, it was kind of interesting to me that there was a different count from Numbers 1. And
yeah,
basically there
yeah,
was...
We're going to take a look at that in some good detail.
Okay, so I won't take your fire.
There's good reason for why those numbers are, in some cases, pretty drastically different.
So I actually took the time to total the number
of lofts. He took the time, wow.
And the number of...
Your accountant must love you.
So that was the only thing that I just noticed. And I don't know what the time difference from Numbers 1 to Numbers 26 is.
Yeah,
I don't know what time.
About 4 decades.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Because, you know, it's kind of like spans the wandering. You got at the front end of the wandering and kind of tail end of the wandering. It's the handoff of the first generation to the second. Any other thoughts here before we get going too much further? The doors. Can you please open those doors over there? Thank you. Alrighty, any other thoughts before we get going much further? All right. Well, one of the we have another one. Well, one of the things that you'll note as we get started is it's kind of like between thoughts. That's why I started kind of earlier back in chapter 25 before getting going too far into the section we're talking about today, because it really is kind of a continuation of what was happening there at the beginning part of what's recorded in Numbers 25. So, as we were looking at the last one, it was titled Balak, and it's about Balak and Bilam or Balaam. What was all that about? What was this great crisis that came up to what you see at the beginning part of 25 leading into that one? What happened? It was so significant, it's even talked about in the book of Revelation. What happened? See it mentioned there, verse 1 of 25. Chapter 25, verse 1. They were playing nice. They were playing loyal, very loyal, having a saying, wow, the Lord is with us. Says playing the harlot, and that kind of factors big into what you see, that kind of very shocking incident with the high priest, the guy's name is talked about here today, Pinchas or Phinehas, going to become the pass off on the priesthood here, spears him through. One of the sons of Aharon spears them through. Wow, isn't that a big overreaction? I mean, you know, it was just about, you know, two adults, consenting adults, engaging in behavior. You know, very strong sort of thing to happen. What's the big deal? What's the big deal that was so drastic? It not only didn't just wait till, you know, the parties were not so engaged, but had to do so in the midst of it. What is the big deal? Yeah, we have an observation down here.
What wasn't she a Moabitess? And they weren't supposed to
It talks about she was from a, it mentions her later, Midian, but of any just rank and file of Midian? Of any just rank and file? Mentions her by name in here.
Yeah, I noticed that, but they didn't want...
Mentions her by name. Okay, well, who was she? Verse 15, the name of the Midianite woman who was slain was Cozbi, the daughter of Zur, who was head of a people of a father's household. So, was a part of a head of a household in Midian. So, what was Midian doing? They had, as we saw in the last time around, what did they do? They came in, they conspired with those of Moab, and they led people away from Israel, led them away. And you see that later brought up in Revelation, that this kind of, it mentions harlotry. What then is the big deal about this? That such a horrific action had to take place with this. We're in Numbers 25, right in the beginning part of this. So, one of those things that we have to wrestle with is, why is this significant? Because you might talk about this, why does this section start with they played the harlot and end with a very long expansion upon the offering, the korbanot. A covenant of peace with the priesthood. It was a forming a covenant with priests because of Phinehas, Pinchas, went and took this drastic action. But this section starts with the people running after and being engaged with, being drawn away from. And then it ends with the korbanot. Two chapters of it. I mean, if you would think, well, okay, wouldn't one be enough? And especially with the chapter 29 as it's divided up, you'd say, well, couldn't you just do et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and clear that up? But no, it goes into great length on the offering. Yes. Do you have a thought here? Deanne, do you have a...
Oh, yes. I don't know if I'm going to ask you, are these the ones that would do false worship and then they would have relations with the priestess and thinking that was part of their prayer and that's what they were doing?
Midian.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. You see kind of hints of that when they enter the land. And you, like, for example, later on you'll see some encounters and even, interestingly, it comes into it as a sort of side mention. They talk about, Aaron, Onan, mentioned because in the line of Yehuda. And that whole, you could say, little detour from the life there when, you know, during the time of Yosef down in Mitzrayim, you know, Yehuda goes off on that journey, since he went down from his brothers. Kind of, you get this idea, he kind of slid from the family.
Yeah.
And his one brother, Yosef, went off, not on his own volition.
Yeah.
And got hauled away, sold, yet still remained true to where his family took him. The other brother went off, and you can see, I mean, for all the stuff you see going on there in Genesis of where Yehuda was off and finally ends up with his daughter-in-law in a pretty bad situation there. But that whole thing spanned a considerable amount of time when you start looking at how old the kids are getting and such. So that departure took. Yeah, so you had Yosef leave when he was 17, and then you had his other brother, the older brother, go off on that other journey. So, but what you see mentioned there in the encounter with Yehuda was, what did he think his daughter-in-law was?
What?
He mentions her as, in some cases, a translation will put as a temple prostitute. So, you'll see that in the land of Canaan, they had similar sorts of practices, and you'll see that in the influence that see later on with if the what we call the Philistines, those the sea adventurers, the invaders, if they indeed did kind of come down from descended through Cyprus and from Greek culture, that was very typical of what you saw in some of the cults related to Greek deities, is that a part of their worship was, you know, relations with the prostitute. So this is an image that you see that spills all the way down through from the time of Yehuda there, his little, how would you call it, walkabout, as they might say in Australia, is finding himself. He did manage to find himself only after his daughter-in-law made him face up to how far he had actually gone down from his family and his brothers. But it's gone through that time all the way down through, and that's why you see it all also mentioned. Mentioned in cases of like the Whore of Babylon. You see that mentioned in Revelation. This picture again and again and again of what is your connection to the Lord? And what is taking you away from that connection to the Lord? And are you noticing how God is trying to make a connection with you? Because how does this section in Pinchas start in chapter 25? Rebellion. And how does it end? The offerings, the korbanot. And as we were going through Leviticus, what did we recall about what the korbanot are? We get into a little bit of that later, but korban means, literally it comes from a term that means to approach. So a korban, a gift, an offering, is that which approaches. So thus you are seeing, and I'll kind of get to it in a bit, but the section right after the first few verses there, 25 really, actually, you know, 25 and then 26 and on through there through 29 is almost like it's like a parenthetical insert. Because as we get into some of our readings coming up, we'll see that what we see there in this action at the beginning of 25 is continued on later. It's almost like it's just somebody put a bookmark in it and then stuck this thing in there. So in the midst of this story of utter rebellion, you've got this picture of approaching, the things that approach, the ways that you can approach, and goes into extremely detailed in chapters 28 and 29 here. So one of the things to just take a look at first off is the name of Phinehas, because we always talk about names here. One of the things to note about the name of Pinchas is, you see, lexicons kind of come up with two different approaches to what Pinchas means. You might see those reflected in some of your lexicons or dictionaries. And one of which comes from that perhaps this is a loan word from some of the Egyptian languages. And in which case, it means a man who is black, black-colored skin, dark skin. So thus, is he somebody from, you know, southern Africa, you know, the Nubians, as they were described at this particular time. Is that what that's describing? Well, the other observation that folks have taken is, well, perhaps that Pinchas is two different words from Hebrew, or with pe, which means mouth, and nachash, which we've encountered that one before, right? Back with the snake on the pole. that's a serpent. So, interesting. Mouth of a mouth of a serpent, or it's which is really a particularly interesting thing. But if you look down further, one of the things of the picture of Nahash with the hissing, we saw that with the snake on the pole, was that a little bit of divination can almost be talked about as Nahash, or the hissing of someone who's trying to tell you something, murmuring, whispering, something like that. So the interesting picture is here that you could say the mouth of a serpent. Well, we encountered that in reading before. Those mouths of those serpents, you didn't want to be on the receiving end of those because you were toast, unless you looked at the serpent on the pole. Or you see that it is the mouth of someone whispering or talking, bringing something, a revelation in. So with Pinchas, we see what his role comes in this particular story at the beginning part. What does he do at the beginning part? It says that he picked up this spear and, yes, so as it ran it right through them. But one of the things that it says right at the beginning part of the section we're looking at today is that the Lord is saying that this Phinehas turned away my wrath from the sons of Israel, and that he was zealous with my zealousness, or my jealousy among them, that I did not destroy the sons of Israel in my zealousness. Therefore I say, I give him my covenant of peace. Wow. The guy who drives a spear through two people is now bringing the covenant of peace. Does that strike you as odd? It should. It should strike you as odd that which is inflicted with violence is something that brings peace. He stopped. Interesting. He stopped what? What did he stop? Stop the getting pregnant, the mixing of two different peoples. Okay. Yeah. Big slap in God's face, especially since the rebellion that happened in the section we were looking at before, in the previous week, where they died too. But one of the interesting things is, what did he actually stop? He stopped the wrath of God. So that's one of those bizarre things that we have to really struggle with, is that what is it that we actually face in this world? There are some that do want to destroy society. You know, they might not have kind of the stereotypical or cardboard cutout villain from a bad action movie, but they, in their small ways, do just pick apart. They strike at whatever is available, lash out. So what is it then that you do about that? To bring well-being, to bring peace, what then must be done? You know, one of those things that's like the catchphrase is that sometimes peaceful people have to use violence to subdue the violent. Now, does that mean that just everybody just picks up something and lashes out? No. It just means that you have to restrain. You have to take care of what the influence is that is dragging down everything else. You cannot let it persist. You cannot let it go. Whether you're talking about we look at our own body like a cancer. If it's metastasizing, which means it's replicating uncontrollably, what do you do? Just ignore it? Just let it go? This will be, all the other cells in your body will be peaceful. We'll do this and that. No. And in your own behavior, one of those things that the Apostle Paul says, he talks about take every thought captive and make it what? Kind of mix it in, blend it in with whatever you want to do and kind of turn out with your jello approach to God. The heavenly jello. That's what you become. Instead of someone standing upright, you go blah, 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 blah. Just kind of bend and blow to whatever is happening in the world. No, it says you take every thought captive and you do what? You make it subject to. And the words in there is pretty strong, that you basically seize it and you make it subject to the law of the Messiah. So, what does the Messiah, was one of his titles there. We read about that as we were going through Hebrews. The King of Shalem, King of Peace, King of Righteousness. Well, what is one thing we also see in Revelation? Is that he comes with, there are various imagery that you see that with. He's got like a flaming sword, comes out of his mouth, which is a pretty interesting picture that you have there. Basically what his words, the word of God and those words bringing a pretty harsh result. So, what is it that we do in ourselves when we see this kind of a thing? When we get the Midian enticement come in. What do we do? Do we take drastic action before it gets totally in and then the whole part of our lives is taken over by it? Or do we bring in the reinforcements? And Pinchas, the reinforcement, the mouth of the serpent that is going to deal with this intrusion into the camp to take care of it. Yes, we have a comment down here. Yes.
Not sure I'm following completely. Some of this is a little disturbing in that if we do
it should be disturbing.
If we do it to ourselves, yes. We take care of ourselves. We have to cast out the stuff that's in us that's wrong. We have to cut off the arm or gouge out the eye that's making us offensive. But we don't have a high priest right now. Who is the authority that can go in and stab the people that are doing it wrong?
Well, one of the things that Paul brings out, like in Romans 13 is a good example of that, is that God has delegated those things to what we call the authorities around. Now, well, see, that's the thing. And that's one of those things that you say that, yeah, they do take care of those situations. But, for example, a lot of us right now are worried about North Korea. Okay? Well, North Korea, though they take care of stuff, enslave hundreds of thousands, millions of people. They're threatening everybody around them, That is a power that is on the planet, but what is it doing? It is not bringing shalom, not even in the slightest. So that is not what Paul is talking about with like, okay, that is what God intended. Because when God is working through and he gives the sword into the hands of the authorities around to keep order, well, you see that even with Israel, which was God established, they even got that wrong. Large, hundreds of years of Israel's history was nothing but oppression of people, enslavement even of people. We saw King Solomon, the wise one. He enslaved people, forced them to work, to build the temple even. So even those that God establishes, specifically establishes, even they can get that wrong. But that's one of those things we also see in the Torah. You don't take in the action yourself. You see something going on, no, you don't take the action yourself. In fact, sometimes it even goes as strong as that, you know, if you start getting all vigilante on something, it might come down upon you. So that's one of those things that some of the people who started this particular country got that part right when they said that if you have a society that's built upon freedom, it can only be free if the individuals restrain themselves. Self-govern is how they talk. If you don't self-govern yourself, what then happens? Then the controls and the fences and such have to multiply.
We have to avoid someone else to take vengeance for. Vengeance belongs to the Lord.
Right. So vengeance does belong to the Lord. What right do we have to appoint someone else to take vengeance for us? Well, when you talk about a society that you have, and you say we want to have law and order, and so you kind of start from the top. Well, at least you should. You know, there are some societies that have started from the bottom. Basically, we are going to have law and order from the bottom up without any sort of like principles and restraints like that. And our country and France, in modern times, post the kings, they took those two different routes. We, in our country, at least started from the top and said, what is it we want our society to look like? They said, we don't want a king. And it started from the bottom up. Well, it took the reign of terror. I mean, I can't believe people actually celebrate Bastille Day. That was one of the greatest disasters in life. Sure, you threw off a king, but wow, look at what came after it. The Reign of Terror and Napoleon. So if you don't have any sort of base for where you start a society, when you throw off the chains, look out. Something worse than your king might be coming in behind you. And that's one of those things that we see with the Pesach, freeing Israel from their oppression. It's like just everybody, all y'all go free and just kind of scatter all over the place. No, the idea was to, in a sense, they were herded first by the Egyptian army. You know, they were led out and then pursued behind. So they were kind of like herded through, then their escape route down through the sea, and then finally led to the mountain. It's like, okay, you're free, but free to do something. That's why the Apostle Yaakov talks about the law of God is like the law of liberty. Well, yeah, it will lead you towards freedom and it will lead you towards peace. But wow, you have to be careful about how you handle yourself in the process. Because one of the big things that the Apostle Paul rails against and why he is often misunderstood is that people were doing just that. They were doing the delegating of their you go get them because they're doing something bad. And so you know, after the time of the Maccabean period where you had the temple was desecrated by the Seleucid Empire, a Greek empire, then they put it back in, they reconsecrated it, thus the celebration of Hanukkah. But after that period, you then was like, well, we don't want that to happen again with the exiles and all that stuff that came before. So thus you started seeing developing in some of the early rabbinical writings what they would call fences around the Torah. Now, those, you could say, fences are great. But wow, you have to be careful about them. You have to really be careful about what you set up as a fence around it, because you may find yourself on the other side of the fence when the too many of those fences go up. And that is indeed the situation where you saw there in the first century where, you know, Yeshua and the Apostle Paul and the Apostle Peter, where they encountered these things. They encountered there were these blocks between the people and God. And actually, one of those, kind of a looking into the future of where we're going with this, but one of those ideas of fences, when I talk about fences good, fences bad. Fences are bad if you are keeping the people who want to approach and God wants them to approach, and you are blocking their approach, which is what you see there in Acts chapter 15, where it's like, well, do you have to be circumcised to be saved? That was a big fence. Well, it's like, what is the history of Israel? Abraham didn't first. So what then are we putting that barrier in front of other people for? So that fence has got to go down. And the Apostle Peter also saw that with the sheep there in Acts chapter 10. It's like, do not call people common and profane when God has lifted them up and made these people holy. So, yeah, you have a comment?
Yeah, I'm a little slow. So it just kind of sunk in as you were talking back a bit. But it's absolutely amazing to me that Phineas, whose name could be the snake or the mouth of the snake or the hiss of the snake, but, you know, you go back to the curse and that was put on Israel for disobedience, and then Moshe put up the serpent, and those that came to the serpent and touched it were cured. And in the same aspect, you know, God was ready to curse the people, and they were already ready to go slay them. Here comes Phineas, whose name is the snake, the same kind of resemblance. He takes it in his own hands, slays the two people in front of everybody, and the curse is ended. So the parable is just quite amazing. His name, the parable, what it all stood for, I mean, and the fact that then the covenant of peace, it was like, okay, you guys are getting this. And then we know the rest of the story and how that turned out.
Yeah, pay attention to what actually brings peace. We may think that peace is nothing but just the, you know, the stopping of hostilities. Well, it could also be the time period where everybody's reloading. So
yeah.
That's just not having any aggression does not necessarily mean peace, especially not shalom, where people are in a sense of well-being. We are where we need to be. We are okay. No matter what is swirling on around us, we are in shalom. We are okay. So one of those questions that you were bringing up about the census, kind of moving on into chapter 26. So with the second census, you saw this kind of mentioned at the beginning, and they see it mentioned at the end of the census, that they specifically mentioned, look, Moshe and Aharon did not call for this thing. Why? Why is that so important? Because you saw back in chapter 1 of Numbers and such about the picture of not wanting the people to number themselves, not having the people numbering themselves. What is the difference with God calling for the census and people calling for the census? Because we see some of the things that the census was called for about determining the fighting force, and specifically in this case about apportioning land for where people go. Yes? Yeah, for determining who is going to be in the army, you know, from age 20 and above. And that when you start looking at the numbers of why they went up and down, you also have to keep in mind that for everybody except for Levi, the census was for age 20 and above. And part of that is for people to be into the fighting force, the defense. Are you going to be a part of the defense of what God is setting up? The other part is apportioning the land. It's not going to be a popularity contest, not going to be a superiority contest for what name of the tribe came first, whether Reuben or Yehuda, fight between those. It's going to be based on population, and then that area being drawn up by lot, by a casting of a lot, but a very specific type of lot. Yes.
I was just going to say that that's part of his covenant with his people to give them the land and to bless them with their land. And the counting that he wanted done was for their proportion, but it goes right in hand with the, you know, there's several facets of, you know, covenant. And, you know, I just read this. I can't remember the actual name, but there's an actual name for that, where God gives, where the covenant is over land.
It's like a land covenant. But it goes also to what you just mentioned there, that God is apportioning the land. You know, the covenant of priests given to the priesthood. But as we'll see, because it kind of factors into the decrease in population, but one of the issues in the decrease in population could, you know, likely stems from a case where people did not want to listen to the way that God had apportioned, had chosen who was to be actually leading them. So, yeah. So when we look here at these numbers of the ups and downs, we start seeing that there are some pretty drastic changes that happened here. I mean, you know, the big one, and you know, I see Reuben is a change of only about, you know, 27 only, because you have to remember this is net change after 4 decades. So like 38 years or so is the run up to heading into the land. So Reuben, one of net 2,700. But you see, Shimon, wow, 37,000. It's gone down. Net change, 37,000. It's gone down. And you see, the God has 5,100 down. Yehuda, okay, big, you know, biggest tribe here altogether when you look at it. And it's gone up just a tad bit. So when you start seeing that growth from a big number, you know, you're thinking that, well, maybe it should have grown more, but the net difference was only 1,900. Issachar, 9,900 up. Zebulun, 3,100 up. Ephraim, down, net loss of 8,000. But look at Manasseh, net gain of 20,500, nearly double in size. Then you had Benjamin, net change of 10,200. Dan is up 1,700. Asher, look at another big jump of almost 12,000 there. And Naphtali down, another big loser at 8,000 net. So overall, this is a net change over all of that of 1,800 less over 4 decades.
And then by Ben, instead of Yahweh, that would have been probably less than 100,000.
Yeah, if it was done by... Yeah. Yeah, I guess you would say like losses of people and such. Yes. Well, you'd also say that, you know, there could have been a lot more losses from vengeance. Well, when we talk about... Remember you're seeing here about the testing 10 times? Well, if you think back to a lot of those testings, there are some of those testings that involve plagues. Whether it's talking about, you know, the quail between their teeth and they died and the fire coming out. And we see Levi, they had a net gain over that period of time of 700. So they went up to 23,000. So in this, you start saying, well, what is going on with this, the change in population here? Well, one of the first things you see is with Reuben. Well, Reuben, we see there, Reuben down 2,700. But what is one of the big things that, and it's even mentioned in this census, what is a big thing that happened to Rubain over time? It's recorded in Numbers chapter 16 and 17. Korah, the Korah Rebellion. Korah Rebellion is recorded there in Numbers 16 and 17. And that led to a big change there with first you had the ringleaders go down in the pit and fire came out after 250 other leaders. Then you had another 14,000 that were taken down in another plague that was only stopped when the father, Zaharon, went running out. He went running with the censer into the midst of the people dying, and he made atonement for them and stopped it. So, in that case, it was like, it's kind of an interesting thing to go back and take a look at this, because it helps us kind of put into perspective this issue that we're seeing here at the beginning part of Numbers 25. Because if you look back and you see, you know, the Korah rebellion there is recorded, the ringleaders were Korah, and he's from Levi, he's from the tribe of Levi. And then you had Reubenites of Datan and Abiram and On. On isn't mentioned here in chapter 26, but back in 16 he's mentioned as one of the ringleaders for this. Now, what was the challenge? On both of these counts, you had Korah was challenging, it was basically challenging Aharon. So both from the tribe of Levi, one part of Levi challenging another part of Levi, challenging Aharon as a priest, probably by extension Moshe as well as the one who was promoting him. But then you saw specifically with Datan and Abiram, they challenged Moshe greatly, and Aharon, but they challenged Moshe a lot in that. So you've got the dual challenges. Is it legitimate that the Lord has set up Moshe as the one to lead? Is it legitimate that the Lord has set up Aharon as the one to be the chief servant? The chief servant for God. We call him priests. So what you see is what Korah was from Levi, but what specific family of Levi? Kohath. We call them the Kohathites, but Kohath. And what was the job of Kohath? It's recorded back in Numbers chapter 4 in the beginning part, verses 1 through 20, what their role was. But the role of Kohath was for the most holy things. And in Numbers chapter 4, it goes into detail talking about what their role was. Their role was to carry the most holy things. The one, basically the items, the articles inside of the sanctuary. But could they just kind of, like, okay, time to move. So Kohath just waltzes right in there and starts grabbing everything and kind of slings the, throws them in the bags and throws them over their shoulder and takes off? They could not even touch them or go in there. It talks about in Numbers chapter 4 that Aharon and his sons, they were the ones that had to go in. They had to cover everything. Because Kohath was going to carry it, but they couldn't touch it, and they could not even see it when it was, especially inside the sanctuary stuff, when it was in operation, when it was finally, you know, it got to the destination, they couldn't unpack it and set it up. They just carried it. So this you see kind of going forward into this dispute, the Korah rebellion there in Numbers chapter 16, that this, you could say jealousy, really. We are that close. We're just very, very close to being involved in the service, the most holy things in their service. But we can't. Because I came from the family of Kohath, and He came from Aharon. Different families. They weren't allowed to do that. So, well, and it's kind of the interesting thing that you see brought up in this point, and kind of fast forwarding to Numbers 16, verse 3. And, you know, Sakura, he goes up, he says, "You have gone far enough, for all the congregation are holy, every one of them, and the Lord is in their midst. So why do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord?" So that's what was Korah's point. Then you see later on in verses 5 through 7, you know, Moshe, when he hears this, it says he falls on his face for the Lord. And he says, "Tomorrow morning the Lord will show who He is and who is holy, and who will bring Him near to Himself. Even the one whom He will choose, He will bring near to Himself. Do this, take censers for yourselves, Korah and all your company, and put fire in them. Lay incense upon them in the presence of the Lord tomorrow. And the man whom the Lord chooses will be the one who is holy. You have gone far enough, you sons of Levi." So it's really quite interesting is that, you know, Korah uses the phrase, you know, the Rav Laham, you know, "You have gone far. It's too much for you. You know, you've gone too far." And what does Moshe say back? "You've gone too far." And almost in a sense, do you want to take it even further? Because tomorrow it's going to go further. Are you going to take this further? But then also, he keeps mentioning, look at who the Lord is going to bring near. And that the bring near is the verb form of what? Karab. It's where we get korban from. The korbanot. The offering. The things that approach near. So basically, you had Moshe was saying to these rebels, it's like, you're involved with carrying these most holy things, which are involved with bringing the people near to God. And now you're quibbling with who is supposed to be in charge of bringing, you know, the service of bringing people near to God. Well, the Lord is the one who always brings people near into His presence. So you all will see tomorrow again who the Lord will bring near into His presence. And then in Numbers chapter 17, you see the thing with Aaron's rod, where it takes it even further. It's like, okay, well, we put it forward with a pretty graphic display of who the Lord put in charge to bring people near. Now you can see that the Lord can make even that which seems like it's dead bring forth life. So be very, very careful in saying that, who is this guy Aharon? Who is this guy Moshe to actually lead the people?
They're just the ones that he appointed.
They're just the ones that he appointed, but the question is that do we accept that? And one of the age-old things that goes back to one of the first rebellions after they came across the sea, when you see it recorded in Exodus 17, it's like, you know, is the Lord with us or not? That has been a continual thing. Is the Lord with us? Is the Lord with us? Is the Lord with us? Almost in. And it still goes on today. It's the typical thing when we, quote, lose faith, one of our key questions is God, are you there? Are you there? Are you listening? Do you hear me? Are you paying attention? Yeah. It's really, really graphic and pretty dramatic with these things that we see in what we've read here so far in Numbers. But the things that happen today can be also pretty dramatic. But as it is now, as it was then, you have to be paying attention to what the Lord is actually doing. Not what you think the Lord should be doing or what you think the Lord is doing. That was a big problem in the first century. They weren't paying attention to what the Lord was actually doing. The smart ones, as we've talked about with Gamaliel there in the Sanhedrin, he was like, maybe the Lord is doing something here. We have to keep an open mind about this. And that's something that, you know, the people of God, and sadly even others outside of the people of God, have had challenges with that over time, is, are you actually paying attention to what God is actually doing? Which is
why when you read the book of Jonah, that's a pretty startling indictment where you have a foreign power can pay attention to what the Lord is doing faster than the people of where the prophet came from, who went to them and gave them a message. They'll turn around faster than even the people of God will when they have the temple of the Lord, the place where God has put his name. Yes.
I think a lot of time that believers that have been in for a really, really long time just get so comfortable with themselves and they think everything's fine when it's not.
Yeah. One of the things that to note as we go through and we see in the census that, at least in the case with we're talking about the issue with Kohath, that in that case, they all didn't, all were all wiped out. It mentions there specifically that not all the sons of Kohath died. Because that's kind of an interesting thing. You see an example of that in Ezekiel, but also in Deuteronomy 24, verse 16, where it talks about the fathers shall not be put to death for their sons, nor shall sons be put to death for their fathers. Everyone shall be put to death for his own sin. But maybe you should also, and as a part of that, and put in there, pay attention to what happened to your fathers. Because if you don't pay attention to what happened to your fathers, you might go down that road too. And that's really kind of what's underlying a lot of what we see in this particular reading we have here today, and really throughout the rest of Scripture, is are you paying attention to what has happened to the fathers before you? Because what was Peter's big sermon there in Acts chapter 2? Everything that had happened to Israel down through time. And then what was Stephen's big sermon right before he was executed? Same thing, recounting what God had done down through time. The apostles, the prophets, always reminding the people what it was that God has been doing down through time. Look, pay attention to what happened to your ancestors before you. You don't have to go that way. You know, the idea of the generational curse. The Lord has given at least two witnesses that the generational curse is bogus. But it may be a self-fulfilling prophecy if you do not wake up. If you do not wake up and see who is actually leading and see who is actually leading the people who you are following. That's always a big important thing there. So, another one in this list here that had a really bad one, and we see it right at the beginning of the reading today, which might explain why, because the thing there with Rubain, it may have been a lot of folk with who followed Datan and Abiram down that bad rabbit hole, and more like a sinkhole, a cesspit, what they fell into there with rebellion. But that seems to have happened a while back. But with the Shimon thing, we're seeing that kind of like fresh here at the beginning of the passage that we're looking at today. So that's kind of a very sad thought to look at, is that where is our road going? And if we're in the midst of a rebellion, we're in the midst of a bunch of people who are rebelling against a legitimate authority and such, we ourselves are rebelling against a legitimate authority, are we going to turn back from it? Are we going to turn back from that particular thing? Yeah, we have a comment down here.
Can't we say our society, since they have our society
has said that they are not God's people, that
right.
They are secular. We are not.
Right.
When the United States started,
yes.
They said they belong to.
Yes, many of the founders said
nature's God,
mm-hmm.
Which had to be Yahweh, even if they didn't call him that. But
well,
now we've said, no, we're not.
Right.
So how are they the authorities that we should follow?
Yet we then invoke God Bless America.
Yeah, that's because it's controversial.
It's become a popular catchphrase. And if you look at the history of Israel, same thing happened. You know, where we see there in Jeremiah, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord.
He said, you are a brood of vipers.
Yes.
He didn't say, you're the head of the ark, it's okay. Although he did say we had to listen to...
Yeah, because one of the things where he talks about a brood of vipers, and it kind of goes back to something that discussion back in Genesis, where in Genesis chapter 3 with the tree and the serpent there. The interesting play on words there in Hebrew, the serpent was more cunning. And you get this picture of cunning. And you also get a picture between cunning and also being ashamed and being naked, being totally transparent before God. So the question comes in is what is the thing that we are listening to? The thing that's whispering in our ear? And what are we able to discern between the things that are whispering in our ear? You know, there are people who have medical conditions where things shout. They hear shouts, overlapping shouts all the time. Shouts, things, voices of all kinds just going in at them. And, you know, it's quite amazing that for those that decide to not go down the heavily medicated route, that they're able to actually be trained to discern between the things shouting at you. I can't even imagine to have that cacophony. But even today, we've got things that shout at us. Our previous lifestyle that the Lord has delivered us from. When we were taken out of our own Egypt, our own Mitzrayim, and taken out. Our old lifestyle shouts at us from time to time to go back to that way. You know, we hear various people which was quoted to the Apostle Paul, who kick at the goads. You know, you have goad is kind of the idea of you might have seen images of ancient, not so ancient herders who might use a stick or something like that to kind of move livestock along. That's kind of the idea of goading along. So goading along is you get this picture of a person in authority, the shepherd, the ranch hand, whatever, moving along the thing that needs to be subservient, the livestock. Now, do you rebel against that, or do you move forward with that? So when we have the goad of heaven against us, and that is what we call the Spirit of God, do we listen to that voice? Do we even know what that voice sounds like? And the way we know what that voice sounds like is by going through the Word on a regular basis and, you know, asking for the Word, the words of God to be implanted into our hearts so that we're actually kind of eager for them and we want to have these words in our lives that we can check the things that we hear, the things that we think about against those things. So when we look at the census, of the second census there in Numbers 26, 27, that is kind of a testimony of weaknesses that some groups had that are recorded in some specific detail, some aren't. You sometimes have to read between the lines of what happened to some of these populations over those four decades. But it's also a picture of some of the folk who are loyal to God and remain loyal to God. Blessings and curses. So when you see a lot of those blessings and curses, we'll be getting to here in just an upcoming reading. You see that at the end of Deuteronomy, you see at the end of Numbers, that those blessings and curses are kind of like that, a long form of that. This is where the generation before went. You don't have to go that way. You don't have to go that way. Choose life. Choose the way that leads to life, not the way that leads to death. One of the things as we just kind of take a note here before, on one of the sections that be good to take a look at before we go into a section in 1 Kings. It's the Haftarah for this particular section, but it's a very important one because hopefully it will help unlock a parable that Yeshua told that I know it puzzled me for a whole long time, and it gets to that whole point of what whispering thing do we listen to. So the particular section we're looking at, sometimes it's come up as we go through the korbanotes that are mentioned in Numbers 20 and 29 about laborious work. You see that mentioned several times. It shows up in quite a few verses, both a lot of times here in Numbers 20 and 29, but also you see it in Leviticus 23 a whole lot. It's mentioned quite a few times, but also in Exodus 36. So the question is well, this phrase, do no laborious work. Those are two Hebrew words of the melechet avodet. So what is it that those two things mean? The first one of those, the melecha, work, but also business, task, assignment. That's kind of why an angel called, or a messenger of God, they're called a melech. Comes from that idea that someone on a task with a mission, a message, they're supposed to do something. So thus you see the melecha used in places referring to work, business, task. It's something that you are, you know, supposed to be doing. But then you have the avodah. Avodah is mentioned with service, because it's also one other word for a servant, one who is, you could say, that is their job, is their job is to serve. But also the priesthood is talked about. They are involved with the avodah. They're involved with service. But one of the things to also keep in mind is that the priesthood, the Kohanim, are not automatons. They're not robots. Well, at least they shouldn't be. We see some examples in Scripture where, and it mentions in here, we had some bad priests who offered the strange fire, foreign fire. They weren't on the same page as to what God was doing. In a sense, didn't take what the Lord was saying seriously and what their roles were. But their service in the sanctuary was a form of worship. And that, thus, when you see, like in Exodus 36, the beginning verses 1 and 3, that those people were tasked in building the sanctuary, they were involved in the work of service of the sanctuary, or the work of construction of the sanctuary. In that context, it's like, okay, their service was building it, putting it together, fashioning the items, crafting them, this, you know, doing the final design on what they look like. They were, you know, given a rough picture of what they were supposed to be as far as the weight of items and such, but the final design came down to these people who were involved in this task of service. So their worship before God was building it to a high level, to the high level that the Lord had tasked them with. So when you put these things together, laborious work is being involved in service toward a task or an assignment or such. So, and as you see kind of examples there in 1 Chronicles, a lot of that is work of the service of the house of the Lord. But you see the example that Yeshua brought up about circumcision. It says, well, the priests, they circumcise on Shabbat. They are working, and yet they're held blameless. Because of why? Why is that? Okay, service of the Lord, or involved in the work of the service of the Lord toward the sanctuary, but what they are doing is still a work of service. And in certain cases, the Lord is saying, stop that. So what is different then with the case of circumcision?
He did say stop that
work of sanctuary. Yes, on Shabbat, to stop the work in the sanctuary on Shabbat. So the case of circumcision on Shabbat, what then is the case there? Yes, we have an observation down here.
Is it because it has to be done on the eighth day?
Yeah, it's the Lord has this cycle of where he's talking about the eighth day, circumcised to devote over to me to, as they talked about, to rolling back the reproach, but it wasn't a reproach of the particular child. So the kind of the giving into service of the male children and the eighth day, that principle was something that took, you could say, made them not guilty. You get brought up, you're saying, well, it still is work of service, yet what is it that you're actually doing? So that idea of the tasks, the assignments, the stuff, that's why, some people often talk about, the things that you're normally tasked to do. If you can get that thing done any other particular day, then take care of it. Because the Lord wants us to clear the deck on particular times, on a particular calendar, to pay attention to those things that he has to bring forward. But there's also the things that the Lord is saying, circumcision on the eighth day, etc., that happens to be on the eighth day, and if the eighth day is on a Shabbat, then it takes precedence over it. Well, you could say it basically declares you not guilty. So you say, well, okay, it's still the not to be done, but the excuse that the Lord provides is that it has to be done anyway on that particular day. So that is kind of the phrase that you see, laborious work, if you're wondering kind of what that is. Those are some examples of how that phrase is used to give us a picture of what is being referred to. So clear the deck of the things that can be done any other time. But if the things that have to be done on that particular day, such as all the stuff in Numbers 23 and 20, 28 and 29, when you look at that long list of all the stuff we're talking about, that is a lot of work. And those particular things, when they talk about the double sacrifices, the double offerings on Shabbat, that is also a lot of work that has to happen there. But what is the overriding principle for those priests that are involved? What are the carbonate all about? Taking the people closer to God. God says that has to take priority. Get the people closer to God. That has got to have the priority there. So I hope when you see this long list, and if you haven't noticed it before, take another peek at Numbers 29 and notice that you'll have a changing in the number of the bulls that are offered for the Sukkot, the Feast of Tabernacles. That changes over time. Everything else stays the same, the numbers of the offerings, but one particular item keeps going down, 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 down. It goes from 14 down to 7. 14, multiple of 7, perfection, starts at double perfection, ends at perfection, perfection. 7 days, perfection. But one of the things of Sukkot, or the Feast of Tabernacles, is what is that a part of the celebration? We talked about that during that time of year. So looking forward of the Lord bringing people in. That's kind of the long-term look, the prophetic look, whether you're looking at Zechariah 14 or other passages where the Lord is bringing people in from the nations. But it is also a commemoration that the Lord took people through and we dwelt in tents. And not only talking about a temporary dwelling, the temporary dwelling that we all live in, the Lord has taken us through, but also to remember our own. Remember, we always look at this picture moving from Mitzrayim to the promised land as being something that all of us go on. So where has the Lord taken us in our time of being, quote, in a tent, unquote, and dwelling with God, that God is pitching his tent with us, even before we actually get to that promised land, finally, where the dwelling place of God is with men. The dwelling place of God is with mankind and came there in the Word made flesh, specifically, that looking forward to that particular time period recorded there in John 1:14, where, you know, the Word became flesh and sukkoted, tabernacled, skinud with us. That is a fantastic thing that the Lord is saying, look, I'm going to be with you even until the ends of the age. But even at the end of the age, I'm going to bring in the nations. And that's the great time that we look forward to, is that this approaching, the coming near, is not going to be just something for some select club, and if you didn't get born into the right family, you're out of luck. No, this is going to be a call for everybody, everyone who is called to approach. The Lord wants to approach, to get near, to come into his presence. So that's a great picture. So lastly, let's kind of end with a section going into 1 Kings. It's a kind of an account you know probably pretty well. The 1 Kings chapter 18, starting in verse 46. Yeah, really starting with chapter 19. But now Ahab told Jezebel that all that Eliyahu had done and how he killed all the prophets with the sword. Then Jezebel sent a messenger to Eliyahu saying, so may the gods do to me and even more if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by tomorrow about this time. Just a little bookmark there for a second. This is right after the whole Mount Carmel with the confrontation between Eliyahu and the prophets of Baal. You know, mentions about 450 of them. So continuing on verse 3. And he was afraid and arose and ran for his life and came to Beersheba, which belongs to Yehuda, and left a servant there. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a juniper tree and was requested for himself that he might die and said, it is enough. Now, O Lord, take my life, for I am not better than my father's. He lay down and slept under a juniper tree, and behold, there was an angel touching him. And he said to him, arise, eat. Then he looked, and behold, there was at his head a bread cake baked on hot stones and a jar of water. So he ate and drank and lay down again. Angel of the Lord came again a second time and touched him and said, arise, eat, because the journey is too great for you. So he arose and ate and drank and went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, mountain of God. Then he came there to a cave and lodged there. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him. And he said to him, what are you doing here, Eliyahu? He said, I've been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the sons of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. And I alone am left, and they seek my life to take it away. So he said, go forth and stand on the mountain before the Lord. And behold, the Lord was passing by. And a great and strong wind was rending the mountains and breaking in pieces the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire. But the fire was not in, the Lord wasn't in the fire. And after the fire, a sound of a gentle blowing. When Eliyahu heard it, he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. Behold, a voice came to him and said, "What are you doing here, Eliyahu?" Then he said, "I've been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the sons of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. And I alone am left, and they seek my life to take it away." The Lord said to him, "Go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus. And when you have arrived, you shall anoint Hazael, king over Aram. And Jehu, the son of Nimshi, you shall anoint king over Israel. And Elisha, the king of Shaphat, of Abel Meholah, you shall anoint as prophet in your place. It shall come about, the one who escapes from the sword of Hazael, Jehu shall put to death. The one who escapes from the sword of Jehu, Elisha shall put to death. Yet I will leave 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him." So he departed from there and found Elisha the son of Shaphat, while he was plowing with 12 pairs of oxen before him, and he was with the 12th. And Eliyahu passed over to him and threw his mantle on him. And he left the oxen and ran after Eliyahu and said, "Please, let me kiss my father and my mother, then I will follow you." And he said to him, "Go back again, for what have I done to you?" So he returned from following him and took the pair of oxen and sacrificed them and boiled their flesh with the implements of the oxen and gave it to the people, and they ate. And then he arose and followed Eliyahu and ministered to him. So one of the things that we see here with this case was very similar to what we had read back there in Numbers. It was like the crisis of leadership when he went up there to encounter these prophets of Baal and really counteract the king and queen there of the northern tribes. This was a crisis because what did he say during this encounter up on the mountain? What did Eliyahu say is the great challenge to the people who are watching this? Who are you going to serve? Which one? Kind of sounds similar. See, at similar points in Israel's history, they were confronted with this. Which are you going to choose? This mountain or that mountain? Which are you going to choose? Life or death? Which one are you going to choose? The Lord or Baal? So if you're kind of looking at a pure popularity contest, you know, Baal had much better staffing, bigger budget, far better, you could say, adherence to it. Because why? You're up there in the northern kingdom, and what is the predominance of their worship there? Kind of intertwined with Baal and Asherah, and it's very much mixed up, so they didn't even know about the Lord and who the Lord actually was, to a certain degree. So that after this encounter then, and after the Lord gives Eliyahu the victory, and after he then, you know, says, "Hey, look, you know, we can't have this priesthood going anymore," he then flees. Kind of sounds very strange how you then have this prophet who makes such a big encounter, then flees. And he keeps saying as he's going along, it's like, there's nobody left. I'm the only one left. There is nobody else. Which you could say is quite strange, because who was it that actually was decided to come to their senses after the encounter up there on the mountain? The people who were watching this going on, they came to their senses. But you can see that there was this kind of this crisis. But something, I don't know if you really caught this. How long did he travel to get to the mountain? 40 days and 40 nights. Did that sound familiar at all? Going out into the wilderness? Not at all. It doesn't sound anything about after Yeshua was baptized, it said he went out into the desert. He was driven out into the desert. Kind of interesting how it talks about the Spirit drove him out into the desert. What was that? Yeah, he didn't have any bread, and there was no little convenience store, the divine convenience store along the way to give him the sustenance to make the trip out. What? It was a total coincidence that the angel of the Lord showed up in this particular case.
He said Elijah was not strong enough, whereas Messiah was.
Oh, saying that. That's a big difference there between the Eliyahu not being strong enough, and thus you had Yeshua was able to go through it, and to the point of after 40 days and 40 nights, he was then tempted. So it is kind of an interesting little flip there, where you had the sustenance at the beginning of the 40 days, and then here at the end, we have a comment or a question over David is chomping. Chomp, chomp.
I also, when reading the Kings section, couldn't get over the idea of, you know, Peter had to have known this story and how God had said, you know, get up and eat, or the angel, the messenger, but anyways, get up and eat. But yet it was food that was okay to eat, said it twice, and both times he ate. And when you think about Peter and the sheet and being told, Peter, get up and eat, and he's like, I don't get it. You know, this is, you know, I've never eaten this stuff before. What's going on here? And he didn't, you know, and I just find it quite interesting that he had to have known, or he obviously knew the story in Kings and what took place there. And he had to have reflected upon that when this was going on. And
both of these particular accounts, both here and there with in Acts, one of the key things to think about is, are you actually listening to that voice? Because one of the big things that comes through here is the difference in the voice that's coming. Because when you see those other examples of, you know, gigantic earthquakes, movement so much that the ground shakes, fire, when we've seen examples of the presence of the Lord, what have we seen in the Torah? Fire, ground shaking, the Mount Sinai shaking. These are the ways, you could say, calling cards that the Lord has said, yeah, my presence is actually here. But specifically, it makes a point of saying, in this case, this is a whisper. This is a whisper instead that's coming. So, what is it, especially in room like this, when you got a lot of large fans going, if I were to whisper, would you be able to hear it? No. So, when someone is whispering, what then do you have to do?
Pay attention,
number one, and get closer. You have to get closer to the one who's talking. And, you know, in some cases, if you're quite skilled at it, you know, read the person's lips to figure out more of also what's saying. But you have to stop and really focus on the person sending the message. And that indeed is what we see here, is that the Lord is saying, hey, stop and take a look here. There's 7,000 that are going to be left after we go through and, you know, take care of, you know, sadly, the folks that are leading the whole nation down into the cesspit. So with this case, then we see the passing of the leadership. That is, you know, one of the key reasons why this passage is paired with this particular, with Pinchas as a reading, is this change of the leadership over. We saw in the Torah reading Pinchas that there was this laying on of hands between, you know, you had Moshe was passing it off to Yehoshua, this laying on of hands, and taking a part of the spirit that was given to Moshe and passing it along to Yehoshua to be the leader going forward. And what did you see that Yeshua did with his disciples? There is kind of recorded in John John chapters 13 through 17, and he talks about what was going to come. This helper was going to come. The helper is going to come. The helper is going to come. And then what then you see after the resurrection? He said he breathed on them, said, receive the Spirit. This passing on, and it's also quite interesting to note also about the laying on of hands, that idea of this, the symbol of laying on of hands, it's literally, when it talks about there in Hebrew, it's leaning. You lean on what it is. So it's not just going to, you're just going to reach out and kind of tap your hand on someone's head. This is, you get this idea that you're like, you're kind of like leaning on, you're putting the weight on, because that is one of the pictures that's supposed to be passed on, is there is a weight that's coming across with this. So you lean on your animal that is going to be your korban, taking you in close to the presence of God. And the leaders were leaning on, Moshe was leaning on Yehoshua. He was going to be, you say, the weight was going to be on his shoulders going forward. So thus, you see also with Yehoshua, he was, with the Spirit of the Lord, leaning on the 12. And then you see in the recorded there in Acts chapter 2, that leaning on was going to go across a large group of people. It talks about the 120 that were there on that day of Shavuot or Pentecost. So this picture of the passing of the Spirit of God on from one generation to the next was very significant. But one of the things that you see there at the end is with the call. That when Elisha was faced with this choice about follow me now or when it was convenient, because he says, well, let me go kiss my mother and my father. Because one of those things that you recognize quite often is that Yeshua gave people who came after him a very similar choice. It's recorded there in Luke chapter 9, starting in verse 57, going through verse 1 of chapter 10. As they were going along the road, someone said to him, I will follow you wherever you go. And Yeshua said to him, foxes have holes and the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. He said to another, follow me. But he said, Lord, permit me to first go and bury my father. But he said to him, allow the dead to bury their own dead. But as for you, go and proclaim everywhere the kingdom of God. Also another said, I will follow you, Lord, but first permit me to say goodbye to those at home. But Yeshua said to him, no one, after putting his hand to the plow and looking back, is fit for the kingdom of God. Now after this, the Lord appointed 70 others and sent them in pairs ahead of him to every city and place where he himself was going to come. Basically, to prepare the way for the Messiah when he was going to show up there. But you see in this case here that Eliyahu basically presented Elisha with that particular thing. It's like, hey, follow me. I'm, and in fact, even kind of preempting him, putting his mantle upon him. Putting his cloak upon him. So, one of those things that you see is with presented a choice, Eliyahu said, hey, first let me go kiss my mother and father goodbye. But then what was the response from Eliyahu on this? Very similar to what Yeshua said to these people who came along. It was like, if you're going to go, stay. But then what was Elisha's immediate response? He basically, he was out on a limb and sawed it off behind him. Because, I don't know if you noticed, he had how many oxen? 12 pairs. That must be one massive plow. I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen people, even around here, they even have the old style oxen plows that some people use them on. And two, maybe four head of oxen, maybe. But 24? They must have been like, oh, are these like calves or something? But you get this picture. It's a really great symbol that he was going to be kind of pulling the weight for all of the tribes of Israel here. Kind of almost pulling the double weight. Interesting. Double portion was going to be given to him. But one of the things that he did was like, okay, even though I've got this basically this Maserati of plows going on here, I'm going to sacrifice all of it and go on the direction that the Lord is taking, because the opportunity is coming now. Yeah, it's kind of like what you see there in Hebrews chapter 4 when it says, you know, there's a day and he's calling it today. If you hear his voice, if you hear that small voice, don't be like those who rebelled. They could not hear that small voice. Don't be like those who rebelled. Yeah, we have a comment down here or a question.
So is the sacrifice of all of them part of the Corban to get closer to God?
Well, one could say he was getting closer to God because what was his amazing livelihood there, he was cutting that off and moving forward with what the role that Eliyahu had now passed along to him. That mantle, that cloak, that a sign of authority was passing along to Elisha. If he sees him leaving? Oh, okay. Oh, double portion, you saw him leaving. Yeah. What? He who perseveres to the end. So some shall be saved. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, he brings up an interesting point, is that, you know, you have to be there all the way to the end to get it. So that's when you say that you have to like be there to the final end of Eliyahu's service to actually get it through. To get that double portion. That's a really great point. So, thus we see here in Elisha a great example of where we are to be when, you know, when the Lord is calling, and to recognize when the Lord is coming. Because when you see those examples that Yeshua gave of people who are coming to follow him, I mean, those sound like good reasons to, it's like, okay, I got to get my affairs in order before I can going to move on into this next thing. But it's one of those things to pay attention, that if that call has to be now, that call has to be now. You have to get everything in order. You have to take care of... Yeah, and...
If you see the army approaching, do not go back into your house.
Ah, yes. So bringing it up here about Matthew 24, it's like when you see the army approaching the city, do not go back in. Your time to get out is now. But what about my go bag? Can I go back for my go bag? What about my cans of water? Can I go back in for them as well? Yeah. So I hope what we see in this is that in this account here today, we can encounter these passages like 28 and 29 of Numbers that are like, oh my goodness, they're laborious. When we talk about laborious work, reading them, you could say is laborious work. But when the Messiah was talking about, and you see it, he's quoting from Deuteronomy, and he says that, you know, man does not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. Even if we think it may be long-winded, that maybe in that long-windedness, there is that small voice speaking, to actually pay attention, because even in some of those small things might be a message that is hugely important. So, Yeah, be still and know that I am God. That's one of those things I love from Ecclesiastes, because right in the midst of that, in chapter 5, when in the midst of all of that kind of everything is vanity, it's all hopelessness, everything is wind and such, but it's like, go into the presence of the Lord and don't go in there with a big speech. You know, you won't be heard because of your many words, as Yeshua said. But let your words be few. Amen. Any? Yes, let your words be few. Any last thoughts as we close out? All right, well, let's close with prayer. Father, we thank you for giving us such great hope that in the midst of what seems like hopeless cycles of how our lives have gone, our previous lives, the families we've come from, that you're showing us to take the better way, take the way of peace. Father, we thank you for giving us that small voice that speaks within us. And Father, we just ask that you continue to train our ears so we can hear your voice. Guide us in remembering your words, that we can actually hear it when you are speaking and not something else. Father, we thank you for having mercy on us through this, your Son Yeshua. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. Hallel.info.